it seems this is a continuation of the Mrs. Elvium. We're in her home, and this is the 24th of June. I was going to ask you about your stay in England, and you've just produced a talk that you gave in which you do say quite a bit about it, but now you've got a little magazine there which you're describing.
Yes, this is a magazine that the workers in the lab published, I think, every year. At least this one was published in 1930, and it's called Brighter Biochemistry, and it says it's the Illustrated Journal of the Biochemical Laboratory of Cambridge. Well, each member of the lab, the staff, and the graduate students who were working there were asked to produce something for this magazine, artwork or a poem or something to do with biochemistry, obviously. And my husband came home kind of concerned because he had a wonderful idea, but he couldn't draw, so he wanted to know if I would draw. And so we came up with something which was published, and it really now turns out to be kind of a historic type of experiment, I guess. There at the time we were there, there was a David Kalin, Professor David Kalin, who was working close by, and he was doing work on cytochrome, which he had found in the wings of butterflies, as I remember it. And that, it's an enzyme, I think. And perhaps we should check this with the chemist, but as I remember it, it was an enzyme, beginning of the work on enzymes, really. And so it interested my husband, and he got working with cysteine and cytochrome and some of the things that he'd heard Dr. Kalin talking about. I mean, I think he went to some of the seminars. And so his little piece came out of that. He had found that copper was kind of a catalyst, I guess, mm-hmm. for a reaction in the Barcroft of cytochrome and cysteine. And so he decided that was Dan, C-U is the sign for copper. And he called us Dan Cupid, and we drew a church and a Barcroft, which is a bottle, and these two oxygen and cysteine having affinity on it. I have it right here someplace. And so it was kind of fun because it was our contribution. When we saw the magazine, we were a little embarrassed because, my goodness, some of these professors had written poems, and now here's our big contribution. And see, Dan Cupid takes up biochemistry. And here we have Miss Cysteine and Mr. Oxygen going out for a walk, and they're not very much attracted to each other. And then Dan Cupid, which is copper, shoots them, and Mr. Oxygen and Miss Cysteine become a little more interested. And finally, there is a marriage, a reaction, which is the Barcroft, and they used a buffer, pH 7.6, I guess, solution, which took help this reaction, and then finally you get this precipitate, which proves that Mr. and Mrs. Cysteine are drawing. So that created a lot of fun, and reading this magazine taught us, even though we knew this before, how wonderfully versatile these people were. And Professor Hopkins, who won the Nobel Prize while we were there and was considered the father of vitamins, has poems in here too about Eichmann, who was one of the early scientists, had something to do with.
You with said there were some poems in Latin, did you?
Yes, and Professor, have you heard of Professor Haldane? He's done a lot of exciting things. He was also arrested, I think, one time for some political disturbance in England. And he married a very interesting gal who was a Russian dancer, and she wrote a lot of things. She was also a journalist, and she wrote a lot of things. So they were known outside the scientific world. Mm-hmm. And he did some very interesting experiments with putting himself in a chamber with just certain things to breathe and so forth. I can't remember exactly what, but that caused a lot of attention. And when we left, we said goodbye to him. We were with them quite a bit. They were interesting people. She had an observatory at their home, invited us to tea one day, and then she took us to an observatory to show us her pet snakes that were wandering around. It was my first experience with snakes in a home. And that's the kind of people they were, but he was very bright, and he had written some very interesting things aside from science. But he wrote poetry, and he wrote things in Latin and Greek and so forth with this. And so it was showed us the caliber of the people we worked with. And they were all names that became known, even the ones who came from away. Mr. Avium worked with Sharma, a man from India. I can't remember his first name now. And he's dead, but he became very famous. And he was worked with my husband on anemia and iron and copper.
He was already working on that.
Yes, and he came over here. We had him in our home several times.
Uh-huh.
An awfully nice man. We felt very close to him. Pictures of our children in his arms and so on. So,
but you mean Connie was working on that in Cambridge?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was working.
What year was this?
Well, you see, they didn't know they had done the first work, but apparently they were, I don't just remember why he was working for them, because of course the iron and copper work was done here before that. But,
1929.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or we were over there in 29 and 30.
But the patent didn't come out till 1931 or
well,
two.
Well, then you see, that's it. I guess he did the work over there first. I should know that, but I don't remember.
Huh.
I knew his scientific papers would tell us that. I have a list of them somewhere. And then there was a man named Peary from Canada, and Professor Glenn King, who was became very dear friends of ours, did his work, I think most of it over there, in synthesizing vitamin C.
Hmm.
And he, as you may recall, have noticed someplace that came to give a part of my husband's memorial after he died, as speaking of him as a scientist, a fellow scientist. So it was an interesting group, and I think every one of them made a contribution while we were there to glorious scientific research, most of it to do with vitamins, of course.
Is Kaelin the one who was an outstanding scientist?
Yes.
Somebody said that he should have gotten the Nobel Prize. Is he the one?
I expect that's true, because he did wonderful work. He was. We were at their home at Christmas time. They were interesting people, and we were with them a great deal. Mm-hmm. But he was older. My husband looked up to him very much, and his daughter now is a very well-known biochemist.
Hmm.
In fact, she may be doing something completely different now, and she may have gone into medicine. But she had made a contribution the last time I heard. The unfortunate part of not being a scientist yourself is, when my husband died, then I didn't see any scientific journals.
Hmm.
Of course, I could have gone to the library, I suppose, like I should have. But I've lost touch with so many people that I loved all of that. I loved the medical journals and everything that we had in our home, and I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had to if I were going to type some of these things. I was looking up a word today that Professor Hopkins had in his in this magazine, and I can't find it. And I thought, no, I could have found that in some scientific encyclopedia. It's P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-O-T-R-O-P-I-C. It's written to me, that's why I read it. He calls it Rouge and Youngness. And I guess none of the Cambridge girls wore rouge.
Hmm.
You know, it wasn't done much then. And I did, and I wore lipstick.
Oh, it was written to you.
Yes.
I see, I didn't understand.
And he doesn't
you.
Say that, uh-huh. But he told me later. Oh, made of rouge and lipstick, dropping powder in your tea, a summons to emesis, your makeup seems to me. And yet, sometimes I wonder what my sentiments would be if I could once be certain that you're making up to me. Yes, I'd use quite other languages once I came to see that you think me perfect tropic, that your makeup is for me. And that was really something, you know, from Nobel Prize. Well, he was such a dear gentleman anyway. And his wife was also a very exceedingly modern, much more than most British women at that time. And she, it was, who was responsible for the rationing program during the war in Britain. She managed the planning all that. And they lived in a home that was on an old Saxon road, so they called it Saxon Meadham. And when they dug up their garden, almost every time we went out there, they would show us, once it was amber beads that were a full string of them that apparently had belonged to a Saxon woman, and they would find ruins of Romans having gone along that road because they could tell by the oyster shells and things they brought from the sea. So that was fun. And there were so many new experiences that opened up while we were there with people. That was just a complete excitement to us because we'd been, you know, pretty much on this campus and in our hometowns. And
did this handicap Connie at all? Did he feel able to keep up with?
I think it might have to begin with in the lab. They did things differently. First of all, he got there and the gates were locked. It was a beautiful red brick building, much nicer than the biochemistry building here. It was newer. And these great iron gates, and they were locked. And he would go and kick those gates in the morning because the British wouldn't get going until after 9 o'clock.
Oh, I see. And he's used to
getting there. And he was getting there at 7 o'clock, usually, and he wanted to be on with it. Well, then they'd just get there, and then they'd break for tea, you know. And he never had much time for coffee breaks and such. So he would just get so cross, and he wouldn't go to these teas. And he finally found he was missing all the things that they had in seminars here. We had the boys call it? They had journal club and other things. And that's when these men talked over their research, and they would stay till late at night often and have another coffee break or tea break in the afternoon and maybe not go home until much later than our men go home. Well, then he learned that, you know, you had to be a part of that system. And I think then they began to like him, too. They had lots of fun with him because he had a herringbone suit tailored over there. He thought this herringbone worsted that the British had was so beautiful, so he had a suit made, and he was always very thin. And so he told them that he wanted it tailored just right. Well, when it came out, it had most of the British men wear braces, as they call them. And it came right up under his armpits almost, and if he didn't wear braces, it would just slip down. So he had it, tried to get the man to retailer him, which he did, but it ended up that the boys in the lab and the girls too would go down the hall behind him, and they called him Droopy Drawers. And they got so they could kid him about this, you know. So I think before he left, there was a wonderful feeling with all of them. I do tell in that little few cards I gave you the story of their going to meet Professor Hopkins when he won the Nobel Prize, which was typically an American attempt to be, you know, gay and like we would meet the team. And that was not done. And they knew that he wouldn't like that, some of the British boys, and they told him. So
is this when he came back from the airport?
When he came in. Well, actually, he was in London the day the news came. And they heard it in the lab before, I guess, he heard it. But I think by the time he got back to Cambridge, he knew. And so they went to the station to meet
him. The train station, yeah.
And they went, stopped at Woolworths and bought these toy horns and all that sort of stuff. And some of the British boys said, don't do that, Hoppy won't like it. They called him Hoppy affectionately. And then he was invited to the Nobel dinner they gave in London for him, not the real Nobel presentation dinner, but the British people had one. And he always remembered that because he sat next to Professor Hopkins, or close enough to him, that he told him, remember, you don't drink the toast till the toast has been given to the Queen. The king, it was in those days, it was King George. So that, you always remember that they had, and then Hoppy also told him, now there are going to be so many wines and you're not used to this. Of course, this was when we had prohibition, you know.
Yes.
And so he said, don't drink, you know, skip every one or two. So they took care of him, I guess. He seemed young, probably, to them. And but it was a wonderful group of people, and we've kept touch with most of them. We've had Leslie Harris is another one who was there, and he did some very interesting work, nutrition, and then went to be in the nutrition labs in Cambridge, which is was a different branch. And then they worked with the Tropical Institute in London some. And of course, every time we went out on a little trip to the continent, we'd go to Heidelberg Institute or the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, or we'd go to Pasteur Institute, and we went to Rowett in Scotland. Most of our money, we didn't have much, was spent doing these little trips. And of course, my parents had lived in Dresden, Germany, and I tell that in there too.
Yeah.
So that, but socially, we were included in many things. Perhaps not as Americans do, you know. We were kind a little, I think they thought of us as freaks from Wisconsin. They would say, where is Wisconsin? And we'd say, well, you know, 140 miles or whatever from Chicago. Well, then they'd go through the frisking us every time we came, because that was during the Dillinger and all those awful gang. And that irritated us, because we thought of Chicago in many other ways, but University of Chicago and lots of other things. But we had to go through that every time. Oh, these people come from, you know, near Chicago.
Hmm.
So, and their parties were very gay, perhaps more than we had ever been used to in our own Madison, and maybe because we were younger and hadn't gotten into that. And I think the prohibition probably had something to do with it too. But we became good friends of some of the fellows of the Royal Society over there who were in math and physics and other. And we had the fortunate good luck of living in a house with, had an apartment with a Mrs. Goring, whose son became an actor, and her husband had been a doctor in India, and she wrote beautiful things, and she composed music, and it was exciting to live in her house. You sometimes thought you'd go crazy before the music composition was completed. Especially, I had trouble because the courting was, she played very heavily, and I was home longer than my husband, but we, through that, opened up very interesting things. We went to productions out in old castles that she had something to do with, and her son went to the Perth School, and he later was a star in many, many stage shows in England, and the one that we know best in America was Red Shoes.
Mm.
And then he also was in The Scarlet Pimpernel, which was on WHA for a series some years ago. And I don't know what's become of him now. I'd like to know. His name was Marius Goring. And he had a brother, Donald, who was in King's College in England. So we got to go to the King's College digs of these boys and see some of the real college life, which was quite different from the biochemists they all lived in other places. But. And through her, opened up some very nice things. She entertained the George Bernard Shaw came down every year for the Greek play, and she entertained him. How she knew him, I don't know. She knew Isadora Duncan very well. When she came, she entertained him. And when George Bernard Shaw came, we went to the Greek play just to see him. He sat in a box, I remember it well. But he came to her house for dinner first, and she couldn't cook what she called chips, which were French fried potatoes, and I could do that. So I prepared the potatoes. She gave me the high sign from downstairs when it was time. She had a maid, but they didn't do that kind of cooking. And I also made the pudding sauce for him that night, so I have that claim to glory. And so that many things opened up through living in that household. Mm. And the strange thing was, one of Connie's students, Fred Stair, who was his first PhD, went over to England a year or so after we did, and he wanted to know where to live, and we said, well, we had a wonderful experience, but it might not work out for you. So just look, there may be many other places. There weren't too many good places for students then. And we had looked for several days before we found this. And wouldn't you know, Fred and his wife, Joyce, turned up in the same place. They lived there. Mm. But they didn't get along with her as well. And I guess they didn't stay as long anyway. So, but it was interesting that out of the whole of Cambridge, they'd turn up in the same place, both by accounts.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's interesting.
I think the Haldanes are probably the most colorful people in the lab. Mm-hmm. And there was a woman named Mrs. Wakeman. She was a single woman. She was a good biochemist. I don't know that she became famous, but she contributed a lot to some of the other work. And she had a pet rat. Most of the animals are always in cages, but this rat followed her every place. And this crazy rat took up an affection for my husband, so when he went down, and of course they all said, what's those droopy drawers? He's looking for a place to hide. They had so much fun with him about those. But there was a great deal of fun. There were lots of parties in the lab. They had a party for us when we left, and as I say, most of them told us goodbye. They thought they'd never see us again. No. Because we went by ship, and it was an expensive trip for most, and they didn't have as many scholarships and things as we do. Well, then came the war, and they were all glad to come over here and lecture. So most of them turned up in our houses, like even Haldane, who said he had no desire to go to America. Yeah. So
it must have been quite a contrast coming back here, where I gather the lab wasn't much fun.
Was, and we wondered if Madison would look so good to us. We just loved the life of serenity there. You know, you could read more. I just read all. I never had been able to read all I wanted to. And I read so much. And then I had the time to go to museums and do the things I'd never really had time for. And it was fun to shop. Every time you went out shopping, it was an adventure. So we wondered if we were going to be as happy. But my goodness, when we saw Madison, we had the same love for her as ever.
Well, I didn't ask you before how it was for Connie working with Harry Steenbuch, because who was, many people have spoken of him, people have some affection for him, the students too, but definitely it was very hard to get along with. And I'm just curious how, because Connie was, 16 years younger than he was.
It was difficult at times, but I think as he grew older, he respected Harry so much. I think the first encounter I remember was when my husband wanted to read Harry took the Chicago Tribune. And so Connie would come into the lab, and they must have shared an office at that time. This is before we were married. And Harry's Chicago Tribune was there. So Connie would sit down and read it, and Harry would come in. And I guess he saw this two mornings, and then he shouted in no uncertain terms that, you know, you do your work before you sit down to read the newspaper. Mm. You'll never be a good scientist unless you do that. Well, Gang said, I never touched that newspaper again. And at least when he was around. But, you know, he'd been accustomed to a newspaper in his home the first thing in the morning, and he didn't have one in the fraternity, so this was a natural thing to do. And he was always a little afraid of Harry then as a student, that he would not do something that Harry didn't like. And I think many students were. I think maybe not the ones closest to him, but people were in the lab. And Professor Hart respected him in the same way. There were arguments. And of course, the ones I remember the most were between Carl Link and Harry Steenbuch. Mm-hmm. And my husband was the administrator then, so of course he was in the middle of it. But I think his real heart lay with Steenbuch in most of those. Mm-hmm.
But how did he handle that sort of thing?
Well, he apparently handled it well, because, that's why I wasn't worried the least bit when the medical school disorder came up, I thought, well, you handled Harry and Carl Lincoln, so that can't be any worse, you know.
But I mean, would he say, come on, boys, stop fighting, or would he tell you?
Yes,
did he?
I think he sent directives to Carl. I'm not sure Harry ever got one, because he felt in each case that it was Carl's aggressiveness that caused the argument. The one I particularly remember was about putting vitamin K in aspirin.
Yeah.
And that was bad because there was some real bodily contact. And I think if some of the boys hadn't, I'm not sure whether my husband intervened or whether some of the lab boys did, but I know it was just outside the men's room, first floor. And there are records of that in the archives. And the first thing I asked when my husband died of Anne, are those locked up? Because I didn't really think they should be. They were locked up in the vault. Mm-hmm. I didn't think they should just be handled immediately while Harry was alive.
Yeah.
And she assured me they were, and I suppose they're in the archives.
They're still there. No, they're still in the biochemistry department. I asked Hector DeLuca about them.
I think there may be some in the president's office, too. I'm not sure. But it was hard. And you see, Harry and Connie and... Jim Wardell. There might have been one more.
Was Jim Wardell a student?
He was a colleague.
Colleague.
Mm-hmm. Getting his degree about the same time. And they did this work.
They were the two on the... I see.
Mm-hmm.
You did...
I guess was Frank Strong in that too? I'm not sure.
I don't think so. I remember Connie and Steenbach was the senior.
Yeah, right.
One of the you spoke before we turned the tape on about how you asked him how he, well, just say that. You said before about the newspaper, hearing the newspaper.
I was at home when we lived in the apartment, and I heard that extra is in Madison. They often got out extras for any exciting thing in Madison, good or bad, or something like a discovery at the university. And since I was a journalist, I was always excited because I'd been in on the newspaper end of that sometime. So I ran to see what it was and went out and bought one and was amazed to see Professor Hart's picture on the front page with some sort of an instrument that he was supposed to be reading. I don't know, colorimeter maybe? I don't know what it was. Dan Potter would know that. And I was sort of read it with the idea that, my goodness, my husband had so much to do with this, why doesn't he get more publicity? And so when he came home, I said, what is this? And I think he may have been a little bit disconcerted, but he didn't let on, and he said, oh, well, you know, there's always a major professor and there's students that work under him. My day will come sometime when I am the brains for the beginning of an experiment. And so he seemed to be perfectly satisfied with it, I think, when they, and then Hart divided the money between all of the boys.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, it wasn't very much, you know, but it bailed us out several times. It was about tax time during the Depression. You see, our salaries were cut, and we weren't sure. We bought a house, we got a baby and a new car after we came home from England, and then came the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of frightening.
But
we came home from England, and then came the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of frightening.
But Connie had done the major part of the work, or he and Waddell had?
Well, in the lab, I think they did it all, I think, Jim. Mm. And it was Hart's and maybe Harry's idea, I suppose. In a way, that sort of precedes our marriage, I guess, the beginning of it. So I don't remember that just exactly how, but I knew that I'd been over there with him. And I used to go over at night because he had to go back. And
you told me this before, yeah.
I hated to miss out on any time with him. So, and he never minded that. I'm surprised. I don't think a lot of men would like that.
Somebody said that he ran his lab the way Steenbach did, that is, with very strict hours.
Yes,
is that right?
And Bob, my son is working over there now, and he said the people over there that are still there. Some of the maintenance people now say, oh, your father checked every lab every morning. He went through everything to be sure things were working. And I said, well, maybe they resented him. You know, I don't know this, but I said, maybe that was more checking up than they wanted. And he said, well, the men don't talk like that. They think that's a good thing, you know, that somebody knows what's going on in each lab. And he used to stop and visit with them a little bit and talk about research for the day or tell them a funny story. Often he had stories he picked up with MDs or something that were funny. And he had one boy that I remember well. It had a drinking problem, and that used to be one of his major concerns, to see he was on the job and all right. And someone who was close to him later told me that she thought he really, his interest had gotten the man straight finally, because he just realized that he was being watched every day that way with love, not criticism. But. So he was a very self-disciplined man, and he expected everyone else to be. Mm-hmm. And that's hard on people sometimes, you know. And I think he didn't like bare feet in the labs and some of those things that would you wouldn't dare say you couldn't have them now. But
would you say he was close to his graduate students?
I think very close, although the boys have written me since he died that he was Dr. Alvium or Professor Alvium to them all during the time that he was. But the minute they got their degree and he wrote them, he tried to get them jobs, and they corresponded. Oh, all of his students, then he would sign himself Con. Well, now that's different from today. We all call each other more by our, but, and one of these boys that wrote me said it was very difficult for me the first time to address him, Dear Connie.
Yes, so, that's always a problem, I think.
And they called Professor Hart with great love, but the old man.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nothing derogatory. So they, lab people have their own kind of jargon and living, I guess. It's different.
I think it better. No, I'm fine now. I just was driving in the car. It was very
hot. The cars are so hot.
Are you aware of what his favorite graduate students?
Well, that would be hard to say. Some of them, I know one or two that he thought would have problems, and they did, but they've come out all right now. One worked with WAR for a while, then he went to the UNICEF, and he's just done so well there. And I think he just took longer to find himself, and that's why my husband always, when he was in the graduate school, he would want he had a little argument with Professor Harriet. Not Professor Harriet, actually it was Brogdon. Harriet was with him. But they would want, you know, they add up units. An A is so many units and a B. And you had to have so many units before you go into graduate school. Well, he would be apt to make an exception if, not of a lot of units, but maybe if it was a 1.5 or something. Looking at what this student had been through, maybe, or what he had done, you know, and whether he had, in his major field, if he really had done very well there. And he often called them late bloomers, and he was so anxious that they keep the standards of the university high, but they take into consideration sometimes the student's background. That's hard to do with 49,000 students, I know, but it was something, and he thought his own son was a late bloomer, and he kept waiting for him, you know, to catch fire. And he said there's something, when you teach a class, it's so wonderful because you just see it happen sometimes.
Yeah.
And he saw that with his graduate students working closely with him.
How about Van Potter?
Van certainly would be one of his favorites, and I think it's hard for me to remember. See, Hank Lardy and Harry Weissman was one of his favorites. He was a little bit cross with Harry because he was going into medicine, but look what it did for him, you know. And Fred Astaire also went into medicine after he got his PhD. And Fred has done very well. And let's see. Lee Klein went with the food and drug people. All the boys have gone to wonderful, and they're all across the country. One of his favorites was, can't think of his first name. His name is Newell, and his father was the head of the horticulture, did the decorating for commencement and everything with the landscape department, and came from England, and his boy. And then, and Briggs is another one. Soybean Briggs' son. And he's the head of the biochemistry. They call it something else, but it's nutrition and something out at California now. So all of the boys have done awfully well, and I don't know, kind of kept in touch with all of them.
Did you have them out to the house? Or?
Yes. Well, many of them babysat for us. And we always had a party about once a year. At least for students that were working with him. And that's why it's kind of hard. Another one was Axelrod from, there were two, you see, Van Potter and Axelrod. The two or three of them came from the Dakotas about the same time. And they all did very well. It's amazing to think now that they're old enough to retire. I can hardly believe that.
Because
I still think of them as the boys.
Yeah.
And when my husband died, they asked me if I didn't want him to lie in state in the Capitol, and they said no, he wouldn't like that. And they talked about honorary pallbearers, and I said no. Finally, I said, well, what about some of his students? And the shocking thing, I stayed in the car till they carried him to the grave, and was to see that there were some of them old men already. You know, Van Potter and Hank Lardy and Bob Bach. I mean, they were really beginning to look older, and it was just the first time I'd realized this. So, well, Bob Bach's another one. But I can't remember whether he did all his work with Kenny or with the other people. I've forgotten that. We could look that up. But.
Did you know Marvin Johnson?
Yes, very well. And he was probably the brightest man that ever came out of biochemistry.
That's what almost everybody else, I guess everybody else says,
But he was just a character, really. We just loved him. But he never knew what Mar was going to do. But he was so ingenious with mechanical things as well. You know, he could, well, the first one, we started having a Christmas party for the lab, and that was a lot of fun. And they got up skits, they took off, they had takeoffs on my husband, and they, you know, they had lots of fun. But Marv, years back before I'd ever heard of electric eye, he had a coffee thing rigged up, and you put your cup under and it ran coffee, and it quit when it was full. Now we think nothing of that. We see those every place we go, but that's the first one I ever saw.
Huh.
And then he had a Christmas tree that turned around and played tunes. And, you know, he never knew what Marv was going to do. And he was just a dear, sweet person, too. And so, and I think his students just loved him.
He was a new name to me. I mean, he doesn't show up in newspaper articles. And
well, I went to the memorial service for him, and one of the things the boys said, Mo Cleveland talked, and quite a few of them, they said he had no desire ever to be, you know, an administrator or anything. He just wanted to do his thing, and I guess that's true. But he did. He did a lot of very good work in penicillin.
Yeah.
A big part in that. And of course, W.H. Peterson. There were some wonderful men in that department. And that's why I think Professor Hart was great, because he picked most of those, including Harry Steenbach. And yet he didn't even have a PhD himself.
I gather that as Hart got older, that Connie slowly took on the duties of the chairman without being and how is it that Hart asked him to, or that he saw that things had to be done and weren't getting done, or do you know how he felt about that?
He never had any animosity towards the, you know, the things that weren't being done. I think he just did them as part of his job, just didn't realize he was taking more. And I think Margaret might be able to put some light on that. Margaret, his daughter, is Mrs. Russell Larson. You have to talk to her sometime. Which not only is she his daughter, but she was a biochemist of sorts. I mean, she worked in the lab, yeah. She lives in Sherwood, and her husband was in the... related to horticulture, what do they call it?
Plant pathology?
I guess probably plant pathology. I think he worked with Walker and some of those people. And Margaret worked in, she worked for Connie, and she worked for Van Potter when he was at McArdle, I think, and as a lab technician. Mm-hmm. And she said something recently to me, when I worked for Connie, I knew exactly what I was supposed to do, and I did it. And he was pleased. Or if it didn't work out, he understood. But she said, when I worked for Van, I never was sure. And my son worked for Van, he had some of the same feeling. But, and then she said she worked for Jack Williams in regular chemistry, and she felt the same way. She could know what you're supposed to do and do it.
Huh,
so it's interesting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She just told me, I see her quite often. She's a little bit younger than I am.
So that's why people say Connie's a good administrator.
Yes.
Because
he could explain. And he was never afraid to delegate or to give the reins to someone else. You know, some people want to be the big boss and kind of keep it all in their hands, but he never had that feeling. And he early on, I think it's quite customary every place now, but wanted his graduate students to give their own papers. And of course, if they didn't belong to the Biochemistry Society or whatever they were, wherever they were going to publish the paper, he had to sponsor them and get permission. But and they got their names on the articles, you know, that were published. And that got to be interesting because his name would be at the front, and as he got older, his would go farther and farther back, and at the end it was trailing, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was always interesting to me to see that happen. But so I think, I really don't know of any student graduate student who disliked him, unless it was this Van Newton, a little bit of unhappy fuss about the Pellagra thing.
Madden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he wrote me, you know, such a nice letter after Connie died, and he said he was just a mixed up person at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to be a medic, and he wasn't sure whether he had it. And so I don't know, maybe he's just making me feel good, but I don't think he would have had to do that. He might not have even known that I knew anything about it.
Mm. Did you know Harold Campbell?
Yes.
Because he was involved in that too.
Yes. I'd forgotten about him. I haven't thought about him for a long time. Anne is the one that would really... We ought to have her sit down with us sometimes.
Well, I did interview her, but she was...
She's changed a lot of her physical. She has Parkinson's.
Oh.
And there's these... It's difficult to talk to her.
I wondered if it was that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I don't see her as much as I did, because I think it's hard for her to have me see her that way.
Mm.
She was very much a part of our family. And we all loved her. And man, she was a part of that department. She
yes. oh,
could
yes,
never.
It's very obvious.
My husband called her his chairman, assistant chairman. Mm. Cause, you know, when he went up to Bascom, many people thought he'd take her along. He said, "No way would I spoil biochemistry by taking Anne." He wanted to.
I hope she appreciated that.
I think she did.
I haven't asked you, I don't think. About the university club, how much you went there.
Well, we didn't go to the university club very much as young people. We didn't belong, actually. We had so much of our own life. We belonged to two dance clubs and And my husband went to this
Maybe Norwegian. I did ask you that.
Maybe.
Excuse me, I remember you were talking
I told
about
that he'd been put on a committee to study why more professors didn't belong. Did I tell you that?
No.
And that was quite embarrassing to him, so of course he belonged then. And after he was in, you see, it was not a convenient place to have lunch.
No.
From biochemistry to go down there. So he came home, and he much preferred that.
Yes, that's
and
right.
So did Hank Algren and Bill Longenecker and the men he knew best in his, not in his field, but, and I think Tottingham went home, I think a lot of the biochemists did. And so they didn't go down to the club like the people on the Hill did.
Yeah.
Well, then when he began to be on the university committees, of course he had lunch there with many of them, and after he was president, he often had his own committee meetings there. And we must have belonged early because I remember my children going to all the university club parties they had at Christmas time for young people, dances and so on. So that must have been, I have no idea when we belonged. And then I was active in helping put on some luncheons, forums and some bridge clubs, things like that down there. Took my turn at that. And I like to go down there still.
Did he belong to a dining club?
Yes, he was asked to belong to Town and Gown, which was kind of the elite dining clubs one time, long before he belonged, I'm sure, but before he was president, a long time, I think even before he was graduate dean. And it was really a nice group of people, Mr. Scharger and President Fred, and Walter Frauchi, and Bill Sarles, and Mr. Ray Stroud, and Oscar Meyer Jr., and I've entertained them so many times I should know. But it was a nice group of close friends, they were just had the best time, just talking. They had dinner, and they wanted the dinner that was from beginning to end, you know, from soup right through to after-dinner drinks, and they would turn the china, you couldn't believe these bright men turning the china over to see whether you, what your china was, and my husband asked me to get service plates, and I said, well, you know, I don't really see any need for them. We had nice Lennox, and so one day for Christmas, he gave me a cheap willow plate from the dime store with a blank check. And he said, now go and buy some service plates. Doesn't have to be like this one, you know. Well, that was then, after we got to the president's house, I thought, well, maybe I did need them. So I went around and I didn't see anything that I liked, and they were all so expensive. And so I was telling this to someone, they said, why don't you go to Sherritt's? Were you here when Sherritt's was? It was a wonderful antique and second-hand store, great big place down on University Avenue where Gorham Street comes in. It was a big warehouse, just full of things. In fact, I got the lovely rug that's in the Knapp Center there, gorgeous Chinese Oriental, which is huge. And so I went, and here he had this beautiful Dresden china, which I will show you before you leave, that had belonged to some family. I always thought it might be the Shubring family. They didn't want it known, and I told Mr. Sherritt after I bought it, as long as it's going to the president's house, wouldn't it be nice for them to know that that's where it is? But he didn't ever tell me.
Oh.
And the strange thing was when I brought them home, my parents had lived in Germany, and they had worked with this man who had his own workshop of painters for Dresden china, and his name was Mr. Lamb, and his insignia, beyond the Dresden insignia, was this lamb. And so they had brought quite a few pieces which were stolen from me here, but they didn't take my service plates. And they're the same marking. My father was so thrilled when he saw those. And I think any one of them is an heirloom now. But my daughter will have them someday. I can't quite part with them, but I don't have the kind of service to serve them now. But so this all started in Town and Gown Club. Mm-hmm. excited about all this. Now, isn't that ridiculous? These men that talked about intellectual things still, but they like to be treated like kings, and all of us who did the cooking for them were scared to death. I remember Margaret Charger and some of us comparing notes. What are you going to have this year, you know? So that was his, and Yggdrasil, of course, he belonged to his Norwegian heritage, doing that, and Madison Literary Club, and West End Club, which was another, oh, they gave papers and so on.
Was it a dining club?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it was couples, so, oh. And so was Mad Lit. And I enjoyed Madison Literary Club. I still go. It's changed a lot, but I still enjoy certain papers.
You said he liked mystery stories. Were there other diversions that he had?
Not really. He liked them. He always read, you know, U.S. News and Report and Time and Life and things like that. But I don't think I ever saw him read a novel. He must have had to in school, somewhere along the line. He was put in sub-fresh English when he first came. That was a blow to his pride because he had won everything scholastically from the time he was in first grade, you know, the book from teacher and all this that she gave every year. So this was quite a blow to him, but he picked himself up just like he always did and conquered that. But it was simply because he spoke only Norwegian until he was six, and in their home they spoke Norwegian a great deal. He refused to speak it much, even me or Peggy, when we were taking Norwegian, because he didn't want to go back to getting those things mixed up. He had trouble saying the THs always. And here he did all this work with iron and copper, and he had a terrible time saying iron. He'd say arm. drill him, and he couldn't get that word because it just wasn't there somehow. And French was hard for him, but German and Norwegian, of course, he conquered. But he never had Latin, and I think that's a handicap to anybody.
Did he do any kind, I think you said he didn't do any kind of physical activity.
Well, yes, in the yard. I mean, he did all his own yard work, and he loved to spade. And he would go down to the farm, his brother's farm, especially during the war when they were hard to get help, and strip tobacco and the pitch hay and that sort of thing. And they always told he was the fastest tobacco stripper in the area down there. And so when he came, the last time he did it, I remember, they said, oh, well, you're this so... town city broke now, you won't be able to do this. And he said, oh, I think I will. And he got to, they gave him a prize or something for that. And then he had the children go down and they helped plant tobacco and pick strawberries and do the things on the farm. We often went to the farm almost once a week, his brother's.
So silly.
And it was the home farm, so where his brother lived. But he didn't want to own it. His brother wanted us to buy it, but he didn't want to. He didn't want a farm. And our first vacation, the first year we were married, we went down to the farm to take over while the brother and sister went on a trip, and that was certainly the hardest work I ever did. Washing separators and all this.
Oh, I really had it.
And then the threshers came 2 days early.
So we had to feed them all.
And the sister went dry. We had to walk down quite a ways to get water to wash the vegetables and everything. I really thought I'd earned my vacation that year. So, and I think my husband did too. I think he had it. He never wanted to go back to the farm to live, to make his living that way.
I wanted to ask you how you both felt about some of the events that went on. For instance, the dismissing of Glenn Frank.
That was very hard for me because, being a journalist, I had sort of worshipped him. You know, his word choice was so unusual and beautiful. But often you didn't know what he'd said because you got lost in all this maze of word choice and so on. And the average person had that trouble, I think, more than I did, because I was just hung on. He spoke to our classes when in journalism, and so I got to know him that way, I guess, as a person. I didn't know him personally till we were married, but I sort of followed him around and everything he wrote. And we felt it was unfair, really. He was not administrator. He was an editor of the Century magazine when he came here, and why they expected him to be able to. And it was political, a lot of his dismissal, I think. And you know, the strange thing is, when Dykstra came, he had not much training either. I mean, he was a city manager. And so it was strange the way they, it seems as if every time they've chosen someone who wasn't a scholar, things haven't gone too well.
Yes, it does.
And I think that should be the first requirement. And not everybody that's an administrator today isn't a scholar. Maybe it isn't necessary, but as far as the image of the university is concerned, it's always been best when there was a scholar there.
How about the McCarthy era? How did he feel about
he was
that?
That's when he was upset with some of the lab boys, because they were feeling so strongly. Van was one,
and Henry. Yeah.
And we went east to some meeting, and I went along for that time. And when we met the boys at the train, we used to go on the train because you were sure then of getting there. And he used to put the people off on the planes for military. And the boys got on the train with suitcases with Joe McCarthy must go or something like that. And Connie spoke to them. And he said, I don't want us going down representing the University of Wisconsin with that kind of banners. And the boys stood up to him. As I remember, they said, it's our right as individuals. This is our suitcase. And they had a few words. And Kenny's muttered in his beard to me a little bit afterwards, but and he didn't like them coming out for those things quite as much in the newspaper as he did at that time. And then, of course, Van took up the Frank Lloyd Wright. He wanted the Frank Lloyd Wright building, so he began being very vocal about that. He was in our church at